We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Join Wesley Wildman and Tony Battagliano for AFA at the Ark, a special trip to Answers in Genesis Ark Encounter and Creation Museum, October 31st through November 2nd. You'll tour the exhibits like you would expect, but that's just the beginning. Deepen your knowledge with presentations from special speakers and a panel discussion with Wesley and Tony. Head to afa.net/events today and click AFA at the Ark. afa.net/events. Click AFA at the Ark.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Wednesday, May 29th, and it's so great to be back with all of you at the American Family Radio Network. I just love getting up in the mornings and being able to come on radio and talk about all of the things going on in culture and politics and the biblical worldview. And sometimes I become the headlines, and that's always a little bit fascinating to me when you see yourself trending on Twitter, as some of you may have experienced. And unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, that's become a pretty common occurrence for me as I have more and more influence in terms of commentary and politics, and just continue to stand for the truth. And that's really what it is about. And if you read any of the headlines yesterday, which I was talking to Devin, and I don't even know if Adam's here. He didn't say good morning to me, Devin. That's actually kind of weird. I didn't even notice. But, you know, good morning, Adam, if you're there and you cared to come into work this morning. But I was talking to Devin, my producer, and he was saying, you know, no, I didn't see any of the headlines last night. And sometimes it's good to take a break, actually, from some of the more political sniping. But if you saw some of the trends or the headlines, you would think that, you know, I woke up yesterday morning and it was with total shock that, you know, I find myself in a situation where I have actually kept my law license. And this must have totally devastated me. I mean, you would think, as Devin said, that I was like right behind Robert De Niro at the press conference, right? I mean, it's so patently absurd how so many headlines twist and manipulate and distort what's actually going on for their preferred narrative. And you can see the differences in the bias between all of the different headlines. But what really happened is that, as a lot of you know, I had another case that out of the Colorado Attorney Regulation Council, which governs licensed professionals out of Colorado, where my bar license is out of. I formerly lived in Colorado. I currently live in Florida, so I don't practice in Colorado anyway. But after the Georgia case was resolved, then the Colorado bar was coming after me to disbar me. And that's the highest sanction that attorneys can face. I mean, that's literally, you know, the worst possible of the consequences. And so through sitting for a deposition and talking to the quote unquote prosecutor, I guess, you know, you'd sort of call them in this case, which I did with my attorney, who was fantastic. I give a lot of credit to John Rusciano out of Colorado. He did wonderful work on my behalf, has become a very good friend. I talked to Regulation Counsel and was totally truthful, answered all of the questions. And after that deposition, they came back to my lawyer and said, we will offer her a 3-year suspension concurrent with the term of probation, because as those of you who are actually following the facts, not just the headlines or the lack of fact of the headlines, With the Georgia plea, I entered a guilty plea, and in 36 months from the date of that plea, the plea will be withdrawn and the case will be dismissed with a court finding of total exoneration. And so so they were willing to offer that suspension, which in my view and my attorney's view was great and constituted a win, because it is not the ultimate sanction that the Office of Attorney Regulation was previously seeking. So this is great. But if you saw any of the headlines, you wouldn't get any of that, because, of course, they take any sort of statements completely out of context. And if you read some of the headlines, it would take some of what I wrote in a letter that the Office of Attorney Regulation asked me to write, that is now public, and I'll read it to you in a moment. Some of these headlines took some words and phrases, like they do, right? And they proof texted it, like how we talk about all the time, that pastors unfortunately do with scripture, judges unfortunately do with law, and journalists unfortunately do with statements. They take a word or a phrase completely out of context, and they try to spin and manipulate it to their ultimate purpose. And their purpose, apparently, is to try to say that I acknowledge that I intentionally lied, which is not at all the case. And so so this has been resolved. And I want to say thank you so much to the AFR family, for those of you who have prayed for me, who've stood by me over the last several years that I've been here at this network, and some of you who followed me previous to that. It's been difficult. It's been very challenging. And at every step of the way, I have simply done my best to stand up for the truth, not only as a lawyer, because by profession, lawyers should first be truth seekers, but also as a Christian, because Christians should, in fact, tell the truth. And especially when we get more information that informs our perspective or gives us a more clear picture, then we should also be willing to change our position or admit when we were wrong. So this is what I wrote, and this is on the front page of the Colorado Supreme Court Attorney Regulation Council, so you can go and read this for yourself. But it was interesting to me that none of the articles I read, and there may be, you know, one or two out there, I don't read all publications, I just simply don't have time, but for the main ones that I did see last night, it was fascinating to me, not a single one actually linked to this letter. All they did was pick out words and phrases that they preferred to embed in their articles. Interesting, right? So you can go and read this for yourself, and I encourage you to do that. But this is what I said to the Colorado Supreme Court Office of Attorney Regulation and the Office of the Presiding Disciplinary Judge. This letter is being written as part of a stipulation to discipline entered into with the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel. Everything I have to say here is completely voluntary, honest, and sincere. The reason I agreed to plead guilty in Georgia and to enter into the stipulation with the Office of Attorney Regulation, or OARC, arising out of the Georgia plea is because I want to tell the truth. In doing so, I wish to express my deep remorse and to acknowledge the harm that my misconduct caused. Lawyers by profession should first be truth seekers. We should zealously advocate for clients, but never at the expense of the truth or outside the bounds of the law. When facts or evidence comes to light that bears upon our own conduct, it is right for the honest lawyer to take accountability for our actions. That's what I am doing. I do not do this as a political calculation out of anger toward my former client or for any other way some may try to undermine or discredit my statement here, which is simply this. I am choosing to take responsibility for my actions and my association with the harm caused to the nation by the post-election activities of 2020 on behalf of then-President Donald Trump. I was wrong to be involved. My involvement in the Trump campaign's challenges to the since my involvement in the Trump campaign's challenges to the election results, I have learned of the bad faith dealing and outright illegality of some actors involved. Let me read that again. Since my involvement in the Trump campaign's challenges to the election results, I have learned of the bad faith dealing and outright illegality of some actors involved. For example, I did not know at the time of the campaign's commissioned investigation into the 2020 election results or that the president was notified in December 2020 that he had lost. A lot of new information has come out, which I encourage the public to consider. In the beginning of my involvement, I genuinely believed that the election challenges were all made in good faith, basically a repeat of a Bush v. Gore situation, not an effort to undermine the public faith in the integrity of elections. But I admit that I was overly zealous in believing the quote-unquote facts being peddled to support the challenges, which were manufactured and false. Had I done my duty in investigating these alleged facts before promoting them as truth, I do not believe I would be here. I turned a blind eye to the possibility that senior lawyers for the Trump campaign were embracing claims they knew or should have known were false. I went along with it, and I was wrong. The harm of my participation in the Georgia Senate Judiciary Subcommittee hearing is painfully evident to this day. Millions have been misled by the cynical Stop the Steal campaign, and otherwise responsible leaders are still publicly maintaining that these false claims have merit. Lies were repeated, thereby becoming quote-unquote true to a large segment of the populace. For democracy to function and thrive, the people have to believe that their votes count and that the electoral system is fair. This faith in the integrity of our elections was damaged. That is the harm. While I do not doubt this mindset would still prevail even if I didn't play a part in it, I am ashamed and remorseful that I was involved to the extent that I was. There is a lot more that I didn't know at the time that has come out through various reports and on-record testimony that has informed my perspective. Lawyers should always seek the truth, and when new information comes to our attention, be willing to both change our position and have the courage to take responsibility if we were wrong. I truly regret my involvement in repeating and advocating statements of fact that were false and for misleading the public. I would never lie intentionally, but I also recognize the effect my participation had. Let me repeat that one. I would never lie intentionally, but I also recognize the effect my participation had, which is the same. So I will gratefully accept a 3-year suspension in my practice of law as a consequence for my actions, acknowledging the Office of Attorney Regulation's rightful authority over the honorable profession of law. And in doing so, I will hopefully encourage others who still may believe that the election was quote unquote stolen to consider changing their position. Everything that has come out since has only disproven that claim. I will continue to stand up for the truth, even when it requires admitting I was wrong, respectfully. So that's the full letter, and you can go and read that. I'm sure a lot of you have many more questions, which if at some point in time I can answer, I'm happy to. Some of you may take umbrage with that statement, and that's fine. And I will simply read this statement to you, which actually my mom keeps on the house refrigerator. And I actually love this. And you can hear Todd and Copper in the background. They're playing. All right. It says, keep about your work that God has given you. Keep about your work that God has given you. Do not flinch because the lion roars. Do not stop to stone the devil's dogs. Do not fool away your time chasing the devil's rabbits. Do your work. Let liars lie. Let corporations resolve. Let the devil do his worst. But see to it that nothing hinders you from fulfilling the work that God has given you. He has not commanded you to be rich. He's never bidden you to defend your character. He has never set you at work to contradict falsehood about yourself, which Satan and his servants may start to peddle. If you do these things, you will do nothing else. You will be at work for yourself and not for the Lord. Keep at your work. Let your aim be as steady as the star. You may be assaulted, wronged, insulted, slandered, wounded, and rejected. You may be abused by foes, forsaken by friends, and despised and rejected of men. But see to it, with steadfast determination, with unfaltering zeal, that you pursue the great purpose of your life and the object of your being, until at last you can say, I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. And I don't know who wrote that. It is the author unknown. But it's a wonderful reminder that no matter what happens, no matter what people think about anything that you do or that the public or the headlines may say about you, ultimately, all that matters is that we set about the work that God has given you. Because even if the worst had happened, even if Colorado, and I'm thankful that they did not disbar me, but even if they had, that would simply mean that the work that God has for me to do doesn't involve a bar license currently. And so I'm going to keep about the work that God has given me. And haters may hate, liars may lie, whatever. That does not stop me, and I'm not going to stop to stone the devil's dogs, as it says, but I'll keep about the work that God has given me. So when we come back, we will talk more about the headlines right here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
By the grace of God, American Family Association is making a difference.
Bert Harper, co-host of Exploring the Word.
And we want to continue to make that difference. God's called us to it, and we have set our face as a flint, like the prophets in the Old Testament, to stay true to God and His Word. So I want to encourage you to support the work here at American Family Association.
Contact the AFA Foundation today to learn how you can shore up permanent income for your retirement years while supporting the culture-transforming work of the American Family Association. A charitable gift annuity benefits you and helps ensure the AFA will impact America for generations to come. Call 800-326-4543, extension 345. That's 800-326-4543, extension 345. The AFA Foundation, the Financial Stewardship Division of the American Family Association.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And for those of you who are listening yesterday, you remember that we were going to have Joel Rosenberg on to talk about what's going on in Israel. He unfortunately ended up not being able to join yesterday. We are rescheduling him hopefully for later this week. But I did want to talk about this story. This coming from CNN, the UN's top, or the United Nations top court orders Israel to immediately halt its operation in Rafah. So the United Nations top court has ordered Israel to immediately halt its controversial, and this is according to CNN, military operation in the southern Gaza city of Rafah, further increasing international pressure on Israel over its war against Hamas. And so the president of the International Court of Justice, or the ICJ, this judge said on Friday that Israel must immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in Rafah which may inflict on the Palestinian group in Gaza conditions of life that could bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. So joining me now to discuss is our good friend Mike Donnelly, who is an attorney and also a professor of law. So Mike, this also coming as the ICC, the International Criminal Court, is poised to potentially issue arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other top Israeli officials. And now, according, of course, to the headlines, the optics of the bombing of that refugee camp that included about 45 civilians. That's really bad optics for Israel. So let's talk about this in context. First, just from just your overall perspective of what exactly is going on in the Middle East.
Well, Jenna, it's a tragedy, and it's been going on for a long time. And as Frank Gaffney said in his monologue a moment ago, how can Israel have peace when they're surrounded by states that want to destroy it? And you've got Hamas in the Gaza Strip, which is supported by Iran. And let's remember how this started back on October 7th. It was basically the Pearl Harbor of Israel's existence. 1,300 people killed in an unprovoked terrorist attack by Hamas, planned by Hamas. With hundreds of people taken hostage, brutally treated in despicable fashion. And, Israel has a right to defend itself. The United Nations World Court, the ICJ, issuing its political statement on Rafah, I think emboldened by what the Biden administration has been doing, which is sending mixed signals. I mean, look, you know, Joe Biden has said some very important, helpful things, saying that we stand by Israel, even in light of the prosecutors, you know, saying he's going to seek arrest warrants. He said, this is absurd. This is ridiculous. There's no moral equivalency between Hamas and Israel, and that what the ICC is doing is wrong.
Yeah.
But he's also sent some mixed signals. He said, but we're also not going to send some ammunition. We're going to withhold some ammunition shipments. And he said some things about Rafah, saying, hey, this is a red line, or words to that effect, or implying that this is a red line. And so what do you have? You have the United Nations taking its cues from the Biden administration. Oh, so the Bidens don't want, or talking about not letting Israel go into Rafah. Well, we're going to say the same thing. So it's kind of copycat following the Biden administration's lead. What the administration needs to do is be more clear and just condemn Hamas and say we're standing with Israel.
Well, yeah, and of course, the Biden administration is anything but clear, and it seems that Biden has a lot of conflicts of interest, particularly given that this is an election year, and he does not want to go against certain factions in his own party, but also doesn't want to potentially, you know, offend the great ally that we have in Israel. And so, you know, so where does and where should the administration, if this is why I hate politics, and you know, you and I talk about this all the time. I mean, I love civil government. I know, right? I know I'm in the wrong profession, clearly, but no, because I love our civil government and talking about all these things. But how much political calculation goes into all this? I mean, for either side, it's like just do the right thing.
It doesn't look like there's a lot of calculation.
And who cares?
Going on in the Biden administration.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least from Joe Biden himself, for sure. But I mean, but do you really think that that's true on for all of the other strategists and the operatives in the White House, that they're just kind of, you know, flying by the seat of their pants? Or do they or are they trying to maybe thread the needle in a way that, you know, obviously we would disagree with?
That, it doesn't look like they have a very well thought out plan or strategy. It looks like it's very reactive. I think it seems to me that there isn't anyone really in charge. I mean, when you have such a back and forth on this issue, you've got what that is evidence to me of is it's reactionary. It's not planned. You know, Biden wants to support Israel, but on the other hand, he must have some factions that are saying, well, we also have to recognize, you know, somehow that Palestinians need to be treated this way. And I mean, he's building this pier out there to deliver humanitarian support. And the latest news is, well, as we all knew would happen, all the humanitarian supplies are being stolen, you know, by Hamas. And what are they doing with it? They're feeding their soldiers. You know, Rafah is their last stronghold. And it's understandable that Israel, exercising its right to self-defense, would want to eliminate Hamas as a threat to their peace and security, which is what it is. And it's legitimate for Israel under international law, Article 51 of the UN Charter, to defend itself. The World Court, the ICJ, needs to keep its mouth shut and stick to its own business. And the ICC, the prosecutor there, Khamir Khan, or whatever his name is, Khan, he's a British guy who's been doing international criminal work for much of his career, has rushed this investigation. And by seeking arrest warrants, he's seeking them from both sides. He's trying to create some kind of moral equivalence, which is his echo chamber in his, you know, social circle, probably, or requiring in the experts that he's assembled, who are probably very Palestinian sympathizing. So it's a mess. And what the United States needs to do is create some clarity and leadership by being very clear. And they're not being very clear.
Yeah. And I'm speaking with Mike Donnelly, who's an attorney and a professor of law. And, you know, and Mike, it's so true that when America as a world power and a leader on the national stage fails to lead, then there is just by definition more chaos when leaders fail to lead. And yet we see all of this with the UN court, and we see this with the ICC, and I know we've talked some about the lack of jurisdiction of the ICC, but talk about the UN's, you know, world court, what that was established for, and why they even think that this kind of order to Israel to stand down in genuinely defending themselves could possibly be taken seriously.
Well, the ICJ exists to adjudicate disputes among nations. And, you know, the so-called Palestine, you know, you've got the Gaza Strip on the one side. It's a tiny little 140 square mile area. And then on the other side of Israel, you've got the West Bank, which is over 2,000 square miles. You know, the West Bank populated by about 3 million people. The Gaza Strip, I mean, I don't know. Israel's saying they've evacuated a million plus people out of the Gaza Strip. Where they've gone, I don't know. But so I don't know what the population of the Gaza Strip is now. But, you know, it has some status at the United Nations, but it's not a state. And, you know, I'm not sure what the ICJ's rationale is for issuing an order with respect to Rafah. I haven't had a chance to read it, so I can't comment on it. But the ICC is a different body. It's related slightly to the UN in that the UN Security Council can make referrals to the ICC to investigate crimes against humanity, war crimes, genocide, these kinds of crimes. I mean, the ICC was formed by treaty. A treaty called the Rome Statute by 123 nations. The UN was initially involved, and then they smartly got out of it. We smartly got out of it. Israel also was initially involved, as I think Russia might have been initially, but smartly got out of it because they saw this was going to become a political court, and that's what it's been. I mean, most of its investigations have been focused on Africa, in failed states. It did something in Yugoslavia. As well, when there was, you know, back in the 90s, there was a lot of things that were happening that were problematic as Yugoslavia disintegrated and became all these other little republics. And it hasn't had a whole lot to do in recent years. And so it's been looking for a purpose. And, oh, look, we have Israel, small country. No, but a lot of people don't like Israel. You've got the Palestinians. This is a very active discussion. You've got the United States involved here, saying a lot of things. You've got some other Western countries. So they go, oh, here's an opportunity to get involved in something relevant. And so they're trying to be relevant. And, you know, the prosecutor has really rushed this investigation. Most of the other investigations that have been conducted by prosecutors for the ICC have taken years before they have actually resulted in any kinds of charges and arrest warrants. And the thing about the ICC is that it's only supposed to be investigating under Article 17 of the Rome Statute, the treaty that set up the court. It's only supposed to investigate situations where states are unwilling or unable to investigate crimes. And there's no evidence that Israel is unwilling to. It's only been 7 months, and they're fighting a war for their very existence. And they're certainly capable, as a functioning democracy with a criminal justice system, they can certainly investigate potential war crimes if there are any. So lots of problems with what the ICC is doing here. I think it's really undermining its legitimacy by aggressively seeking arrest warrants against Israel. Now, the Palestinians and Hamas, another story. Hamas was and the PLO, Hamas, they were granted observer status under the ICC. So in theory, the ICC has jurisdiction in the Gaza Strip to investigate war crimes, and Hamas and what it did in the October unprovoked attack on Israel.
Yeah, and according to this CNN report, it says the court and this is talking about the ICJ, considers the humanitarian situation in Rafah to be classified as quote unquote disastrous. And that's according to this this presiding judge, and adding that UN officials have indicated that the situation was set to intensify even further if the Israeli operation in Rafah continues. And so, you know, I mean, humanitarianism seems to be, Mike Donnelly, kind of this catch-all term for wokeness often, but also just this sort of catch-all term for then, you know, some of these judges, including now, you know, the ICJ, just to say, well, because we think that there's a humanitarian crisis or whatever their justification, then we can go in without, as you mentioned, more of the layers of investigation and more considered judgment.
Yeah, there may be some provision in the UN Charter for the ICJ to, you know, make a pronouncement and take notice of a humanitarian crisis. I'm sure it is humanitarian crisis in Rafah. I wouldn't want to be in Rafah, I can tell you that. You know, and I don't know who is left in Rafah. But this is the thing. You know, you've got the ICJ sitting in The Hague. What information are they using to make this determination? I mean, it could be that the people who are left in Rafah are there. You know, a lot of them could be Hamas. I don't know. Okay, I'm sure it's a humanitarian disaster, but Israel has been attacked by Hamas. And if Hamas is in Rafah and Israel has decided that in order for its peace and security to be assured, it needs to eliminate Hamas as a threat to its existence, because Hamas has stated its goal is to eliminate the state of Israel, then Israel, I think, has a justification under international law to take measures to protect itself. You know, yesterday we were talking about this, and, you know, when we talk about these arrest warrants that the ICC prosecutor is seeking, you know, he is seeking arrest warrants for Hamas leaders who perpetuated this horrific unprovoked attack in October on Israeli civilians. And he's now also seeking arrest warrants for Benjamin Netanyahu and the defense minister Gallant for defending themselves and trying to eliminate an existential threat to Israel's existence, trying to create some kind of moral equivalent. And to me, I'm like asking myself the question, if the ICC existed on December 7th, 1941, and 6 months later, Mr. Khan was thinking about bringing arrest warrants, seeking arrest warrants, you know, he'd be bringing arrest warrants against Hitler and Hirohito, and he'd also include, you know, Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower. Ridiculous.
Yeah. 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 And it does seem that it's like many things, right? And unfortunately, many courts, it does seem very one-sided and to be more of more political and to be very selective in terms of its prosecution. So in just the last minute I have with you, can Israel just ignore this? Or, you know, if these types of arrest warrants are issued, you know, what happens?
Well, some people have been commenting, and I agree, it would be smart for Israel to set up a commission of its own to investigate any alleged conduct by anyone that could potentially be criminal acts. So that is one thing it could do to demonstrate that it's taking some action, but I don't think it needs to. I mean, again, I think the ICC is rushed here. It's delegitimizing itself. And if there are crimes that have been committed, you know, Israel should take action. You know, there are crimes that do happen in war. I mean, you know, the United States has its own uniform code of military justice, and it, you know, investigates when American soldiers do things that are wrong. I mean, in war, things happen, and it's terrible. I hope this conflict can be resolved. And I feel like that the ICJ and the ICC need to stand by a little bit and wait and let the countries of the world figure this out.
Yeah, well said.
Trying to insert themselves.
Yeah. So, Mike Donnelly, always appreciate your commentary, especially on these issues. And, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, it is just always a black and white issue when you're dealing with controversy, but there can be bad actors on both sides. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
I know darkness is in the world, but that don't mean I gotta kick open my front door and welcome it. Why would we continue to tolerate wickedness at any level? God knows the scope of your access and impact. He knows that. but he does expect you to be his ambassador in your world.
Tune in to the Hamilton Corner, weekdays at 5 p.m. Central on American Family Radio.
You've heard a lot about saving babies on this show, and that's because it's important to me personally. And let me just be frank with you, we need to save them. That's why we've partnered with Preborn, the nation's leader in introducing mothers with unplanned pregnancies to their babies. And once she hears that heartbeat and sees that precious life growing inside of her, she is twice as likely to choose life. Now that's a miracle. But quite honestly, if we don't save them, who will? Preborn receives no government funding, so their work is completely dependent on us. Preborn has rescued over 280,000 babies. And that's not all. They provide love, support, and counseling for up to 2 years for free, saving lives and souls. One ultrasound is just $28, or $140, helps to rescue 5 babies' lives. Abortion doesn't stop, so we can't. Together, you and I can save lives. Just dial #250 on your cell and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we are trying to get a hold of our next guest. So, you know, if we do, then we will talk more about the Trump trial with our guest. And, you know, my comments, I covered this just a little bit yesterday, but, you know, the closing arguments happened, and then there's jury instructions that will be given. But likely the case will be given to the jury today. And again, we need to be very consistent conservatives, consistent Christians, first and foremost, but consistent truth seekers, because a lot of people think that the issue is totally black and white, that if you support President Trump, then you have to support literally everything, right? And that it's completely siloed in. If you are a conservative and Republican, then everything Republicans do, you have to 100% support. And then, you know, Democrats bad and literally everything. Right. And we need to be more consistent than that. And we need to be more principled than that, because things really aren't black and white. I mean, there are things, I mean, even yesterday, in the midst of commenting about how ridiculous I think that this trial in New York City is, and how the prosecution has not proven their case. And I think it's absolutely ridiculous in terms of just the legal perspective, that the judge has actually made an order in this case that the jury does not have to have a unanimous agreement on what the underlying crime potentially is, which we don't even really know. I mean, I like, this wasn't charged in the original indictment. A lot of people and legal scholars, I had Alan Dershowitz on this show, you know, we were talking about this, saying Alvin Bragg didn't really allege what an underlying crime was, because you have to first have a crime, and then to reach the felony and the 34 felony charges in this case, of, you know, the campaign finance violations and all of that, you have to have manipulated your books to cover up something else that was actually a crime. It's similar in law to what's called felony murder, right? Where if you are in the commission of an act that is illegal, like say that you are robbing a bank, and hopefully none of you out there are doing this, but hypothetically, you're robbing a bank and someone gets killed, not even intentionally, while you are in the commission of another crime, then you can be charged with felony murder, because but for the other criminal activity, you wouldn't be there, and the person, you know, would not have been killed. And so there has to be a layer of criminality. You have to have the underlying crime first to then be charged with felony murder, right? Because then in any other circumstance, let's say that you just happened to walk into a bank and you were there for perfectly legitimate purposes, something else happened, someone unfortunately gets killed, then you could be charged with something much less, or even not charged at all, right? So nobody even really knows what is the underlying crime here that President Trump was supposedly committed. And the judge in this case even said that the jury doesn't even have to decide and agree unanimously on what that underlying conduct was. That's incredible to me. And it's just, it looks like it is just political to try to skew this in the favor of a conviction. And so Mark Lauder, who is the chief communications officer with the America First Policy Institute, is our guest and joins me now. And I'm so glad, Mark, that you could take time to join us this morning. And, you know, so I've kind of gone through some of the ridiculous legal, and we're going to see how long the jury takes to deliberate. There are 34 counts, and they do have to independently come to a guilty or not guilty or hung jury. You know, maybe they can't decide unanimously, because ultimately, in order to return a verdict of guilty or not guilty, they have to be unanimous. So it could be that they convict or acquit on some, they're hung on some of the others. So we'll see how long it takes. But so that's kind of the legal, but from the political perspective, you know, we saw some headlines yesterday that the Secret Service is talking to, you know, Rikers Island and some of these places just in preparation for Donald Trump to be incarcerated. I mean, we are literally at this point in American history where that's a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the Secret Service does their due diligence, you know, on all these kinds of things as it relates to security. But that's what we've come to. And the fact that you literally had the Biden campaign staging a news conference with a washed up actor in Robert De Niro. You've got word coming out that Biden is going to speak on the verdict afterwards from the White House. I mean, it shows you what we've known this to be all along, that this is a political endeavor, not a justice or a law and order endeavor. And it's all about politics, because I mean, you saw the stories over the weekend from the Wall Street Journal, Politico yesterday. Democrats are freaking out. And they're freaking out about how bad Joe Biden's campaign is going, how badly he is trailing in the polls. And so they've got to do something. And so that's why they're grasping at straws with the debates, with this stunt yesterday, and whatever Biden is going to do from the White House, because they can't win on the issues. And this is the only case that's going to likely go to trial before the election. They are desperate to do something to change the narrative, and they need to get a guilty verdict. And it looks like, you know, Judge Mershon is going to do everything he can to help deliver that.
Yeah, and Politico, the piece that you're referencing, Mark Lauder, actually said this: a pervasive sense of fear has settled in at the highest levels of the Democratic Party over Joe Biden's reelection prospects. I mean, when you've lost Politico, that's not good. And then also the Washington Examiner had this headline that more Democrats than Republicans even want Joe Biden kicked off of the Democrat ticket, a shocking dismissal of the party chief just months before the election. 54% of Democratic likely voters would approve of Biden being replaced, a very unlikely possibility, according to the Washington Examiner, with party nominating convention set for mid-August. Biden has won his primaries in runaways, but they have no alternative in mind other than former First Lady Michelle Obama, who's repeatedly vowed not to run. You know, we've talked about this a lot. I have speculated when there was a little more time running up to this that the Democrats possibly would replace Joe Biden. I mean, is that potentially their alternative? I mean, especially if, let's say, we get a not guilty verdict. I mean, that would just be devastating to the Democrats politically.
Yeah, I mean, that would obviously be devastating. I think more likely it would be if Joe Biden has a brain freeze, mental breakdown, stumbles, falls, trips over himself at the debate in June. But the one underlying problem that none of this changes is that they don't have a plan B. I mean, remember that the Democrat Party is bleeding black support. It's primarily from black men who've had enough of Joe Biden and the failures and the many failures. But it's been primarily black men. If they replace Joe Biden with anyone except the first black female vice president of the United States, then black women, they may not vote for Trump, but they'll just stay home. They will feel like Kamala has been disrespected. And of course, she's even worse than he is. And she polls worse than Joe Biden does, as hard as that is to believe. So they are between a rock and a hard place, you know, in a hard place, because they can't win with Joe. They're stuck with Kamala, and they can't win with her. So what do they do?
Yeah. I mean, I genuinely do not envy their position at all, because, you know, if you look back to the Republican primary, I mean, I said from the very beginning, I mean, and this was even before Trump declared that he was running for re-election, that it's a good thing that Republicans have a wide bench. And I know, you know, our primary was very hotly contested, but we had, you know, some really good candidates. And, you know, if something happened and President Trump was unable to continue to run, or, you know, dropped out for whatever reason, you know, we have several people that I would support and enthusiastically support, but the Democrats are not in that same position. And so it's going to be interesting. So let's also talk about the debate, Mark Lauder, because, you know, this was really fascinating to me that that Biden and Trump actually have agreed to this, but it's going to be in Atlanta on CNN. Do you think that Trump gave up too much ground in terms of negotiation of terms by just saying, listen, I'll meet you anywhere, anytime, under any terms, and, you know, let's just have at it. I just want to get on the debate stage.
No, actually, I think, you know, in this case, I mean, I think their ultimate goal is to have a direct comparison between Biden and Trump. And what we've seen, you know, whether it was the interview a few weeks ago with Caitlin Collins, what we've seen in the fact that he can't even handle a teleprompter right now. And yet there's no teleprompter in these debates. So you're going to have 90 seconds, 2 minutes, whatever that time frame is going to be, where he's got to come up with a coherent thought, be able to think about it, voice it, put it into, you know, understandable words, not talk about his uncle being eaten by cannibals or him driving a semi truck, and be able to deliver that speech. And if he hasn't been able to show that he's been able to do that, even that interview unscripted with Caitlin Collins, I mean, think about how much editing went into that. Think about the video that he said when he accepted the debate challenge. There were five edits in 13 seconds.
Yeah.
But Donald Trump gets up there and rips for 90 minutes, you know, multiple times a week. He can do this. And Joe Biden is just not showing that he's capable. So it'll be very interesting to see. And people will be able to look at the two of them and say, oh, this is the choice. And it should be fairly easy.
Well, and to push back on this, just because I know that you will have a good answer for this, Mark Lauder, because you're always great in communications. So you and I were there last time in the first round in 2020, and we said the same thing. You know, oh, Biden, you know, is falling all over himself. He can't possibly do this. He's not a great debater. And I remember watching the first debate, and my perspective of the first debate was, I mean, and this was coming, people need to remember in context, you know, after all of the, literally the daily COVID press conferences. And the very first debate, Trump did not do as well as people expected. And Biden was far superior than people expected him to be. And so it was kind of a net Biden win. And my view of it was that Trump treated it too much like a press conference, not a debate. And that didn't go over quite as well. And so do you think that we may have a repeat of that situation where Trump maybe underperforms to expectations a little bit, Biden over exceeds expectations? And so almost like, you know, the Oz Fetterman debate, where literally Fetterman just had to come up there and seem competent. And everybody said, wow, he did such a great job. And so, you know, are we kind of setting the parameters too low and ending up with something that's going to give the Democrats a win like the first debate?
Well, they will claim a win. I mean, if you physically can stand up for 90 minutes, they will claim it as a win. And so there's really, you know, especially in the left-wing media. So there's really no question about that. But I think, you know, then we get to the next underlying cause. And this is the problem that Joe Biden faces, is that people blame him correctly for all of the things that are going wrong in their lives, in the world, and in our country. They didn't blame Barack Obama for the Great Recession. They blamed it on George W. Bush. They didn't blame Bill Clinton for the recession that we had in 91, 92. They blamed it on George H.W. Bush. So you had a wide runway for those presidents to be able to claim, we're coming out of it, we're getting better, we're doing, you know, X, Y, and Z. People blame Joe Biden for inflation. They blame Joe Biden for the border. So he doesn't get a runway. So even if he can get up there and stand for 90 minutes, not trip and stumble all over his words and make things up, he also has an underlying problem that people blame him for these problems from a policy standpoint. And they remember that things were better off under Trump. And so if we get beyond the performance side, that doesn't help him with the policy side.
Yeah, and that is such a good point that Democrats have literally nothing to run on. And yesterday on my Salem TV show, I was talking about James Carville and his rant. I don't know if you saw that, where he just exploded. And for those of you, you know, who are listening on AFR, I mean, we're not going to play it here because he has a bunch. I mean, it's just expletive filled. But he was really mad at his own party, saying that, you know, there's no policy to run on. What are you guys even doing? And was really upset at the Democrats. And I think rightly called them out. I mean, we could have done with a few less expletives, but he rightly called out his own party for saying, what are you guys even running on? Because, and this is where I think the Democrats are losing the reasonable people in their own party. I mean, people like Tulsi Gabbard that have walked away, you know, people like even RFK Jr. for all of some of his really, you know, wonky and out there positions, he's walked away. And you're seeing, Mark Lauder, a lot more people just so tired of the insanely progressive left Democrat Party. And so how can Trump, and how should Trump use that more effectively? Because I would love to see him not as focused on, you know, the ridiculous insanity out of New York that the left wants him to be caught up in, and to say more things about the border, to say more things about the Democrats, and to almost just ignore that and to keep just campaigning.
Well, I think we're starting to see that. And, you know, I mean, if you look in the last 2 weeks, he's had 25,000 people in the Bronx. He's had 107,000 people in New Jersey. He went to the Libertarian Party. He went up to Michigan, which not even Ronald Reagan won. So he's going to places right now where I think there are a number of moderates or people in the middle, or maybe even longtime Democrats because of, you know, how they've voted generationally, are going, no, I've had enough. I've had enough of the gas prices, the grocery prices, the open border, the wars that are going on. We try to ear away, and I just can't. And I might not be ready to put on a MAGA hat, but I am ready to at least say, no, let's go back to those policies that worked. And
yes.
So I think the longer he does that, the more and more he's giving support to other people to go, I'm not alone.
Yeah, well said. Mark Lauder, always appreciate it. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.